Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Liberty Bigley podcast, or maybe it's just Liberty Bigley. I'm your host, Patrick McFarlane. I'm going to come at you with a quick episode because my wife is picking up our son at daycare right now, and that's about 15 minutes away. So a good time frame for an episode. I wanted to talk about an article on Mises Wire that came out today that came out October 7th, but it piqued my interest, and it's from the always brilliant Ryan McMakin, and it's entitled, "The Media is Now Openly Pushing Secession as the Election Nears." So we can only hope, right? Well, I listened to another good episode of Bob Murphy's on the Bob Murphy podcast, I think it's called, and I got a new phone, and for some reason, a few months ago when I got my new phone, I installed Podcast Addict, and my subscriptions did not roll over. And so I realized that I was not actually still subscribed to the Bob Murphy Show. I realized that today when Daniel Elwood from Actual Anarchy, we were chatting on Facebook, and he sent me a link to Bob Murphy's episode, bobmurphyshow.com/152, The Coming Darkness and Renaissance. And Daniel, I don't think Daniel listens to the show. This we'll check and see if he does. But he got really black-pilled, and he seemed rather dark about our prospects going forward. Which, if you are a longtime listener of Liberty Weekly podcast, I was super black-pilled and collapsitarian. I listened to too much Peter Schiff, and this was all very early in the show. I talk about it constantly when Jerry was still the co-host of the show about listening to Peter Schiff and getting woke on the Federal Reserve and Peter Schiff's impending collapse and all of his doomsaying. Well, Bob Murphy Show, really good episode 152, talking about how bad the economics numbers are, how bad the jobs numbers are, and how the true blight of the lockdown hysteria just hasn't hit us, and they've papered over it quite a bit, and it's still coming up. You know, of course, it's kind of like a Frankenstein economy, and I don't know if you've ever watched Planet Earth, where they had, I think, one of the episodes about the zombie ants, where like a beetle or some kind of fungus, it'll grow and infect an ant colony, and these ants are walking around. But they slowly are going insane as their brain stems get eaten away. And I think that's kind of what the economy has been since we completely went off the gold standard. But there's, you know, the Fed has been able to keep things afloat with their extreme monetary policy. But once Bob Murphy's better at explaining this than I am, of course, but once we hit the critical mass where the Fed can no longer control interest rates and manipulate them, and the markets start to take over and finally win and dictate, is when we're going to be in for some real pain. But Bob's episode description is, Bob lays out the grim news. There's a coming age of darkness with economic and political turmoil that leads to large-scale violence. Yet he also explains that after the chaos, out of the rubble will emerge a new class of artists, poets, and creators who will constitute the new Renaissance. Well, maybe. There's a lot of red pills in there about the Fabian Society and cultural Marxism and the real history behind it, not just some crazy McCarthyism. However, the McCarthyites weren't wrong. And I don't know, coming from someone like Bob, who I really consider Bob Murphy to be a genius, legit genius, and he probably would laugh at that. I haven't had Bob Murphy on the show or talked to him at all, but I think he's a genius. And it's a little sobering coming from someone like Bob, because it seems like he's a man of faith and someone who is optimistic and believes in God. He's a Christian and someone who's usually pretty sober-headed, but it's a little sobering coming from him. So I would check that out, bobmurphyshow.com/152, if you haven't already. But it's interesting that even people in the mainstream media are talking secession, and when even, you go back into my catalog two or three years ago, it was pretty clear that you would be called the neo-Confederate if you talked about secession in any kind of favorable light. And I wrote in my law school final paper that I had to write, kind of like a dissertation for my JD, was about the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions and nullification and secession, and that was the logical results of the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, which were propounded on by the two greatest architects of the American system. And well, Jefferson, I don't think he had as much to do with the Constitution because he was in France at the time, if I recall. But James Madison and Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence. So, and I think there's some stuff in the Liberty Bigley podcast. If I recall, one of the first episodes was about this paper I wrote and more about secession or nullification in the Declaration of Independence. But it's interesting to see now this complete 180. And it actually, the thought I had was that it completely parallels and reflects exactly the entire history of nullification and secession movements, is that it's universally condemned by those who have power, and it's universally praised by those who don't have power. And that flips sides very often. You know, you have, for instance, during the War of 1812, this is actually brought up in this article by Ryan McMakin, but in the War of 1812, you had a lot of New England states who were, I think, more Federalist. So the New England states, I believe, were more Federalist, and they wanted to secede from the Union because of our war with Great Britain. And at the time, you know, it was a lot of Democratic, Jeffersonian Democratic Republicans who, if I'm recalling correctly, and I haven't looked at this or studied it in a while, but the Democratic, Jeffersonian Democratic Republicans were more pro-France, and they wanted the war. And this is interesting. So McMakin, it's a little bit too long to read this article. Maybe I can go. My wife just texted me. She's just left now. But he writes, it's becoming increasingly clear to even mainstream media outlets that things are unlikely to return to, quote, normal after the 2020 election. No matter who wins, it is likely the losing side will regard the winning side as having obtained its win using dirty tricks, foreign meddling, or through relentless propaganda offered up by a heavily biased and one-sided news media. You see this all across history, all across American history, this with the issue of secession. And here's the article. If about half the country regards the winning president as illegitimate, where does one go from there? The survey data isn't exactly calming on this issue. As reported by Politico last week, the percentage of Americans who believe it is justified to use violence to, quote, advance political goals has quadrupled since 2017 for both Democrats and Republicans. And I think it's interesting because, you know, the average American can't run down the block. I don't know who said this, maybe Jeff Deist, I think, but the average American can't even run down the block. What makes them think that they're going to be conditioned enough to grab a hunting or assault rifle and, you know, fight a battle or fight some kind of a conflict where they would be a guerrilla force, akin to the real American revolutionaries or akin to the Viet Cong. Just my thought. But of any people, it would be Republicans. You'd probably have your washed up old ex-vets, your FUDs, your gun shooting on the weekend Republicans, but most of them are out of shape dads. Even if they are former military, the conditioning wears off pretty quickly. And if you're used to PT and training for the military, you're used to eating whatever you want or something like it, and then you get out of the military and you gotta work a desk job or raise your family and you get a dad bod. You know, I'm there. I guess I don't have a dad bod, but I can run a few miles at a time. I try to keep that conditioning up, but I'm 27 years old. But you get my point. Most of the country's out of shape. They are not exactly equipped with battle rifles, or they don't have magazines upon magazines, or a plate carrier, or something that they can, what is it, an IFAC, an individual first aid kit that they have with them. So, but I don't understand from the Democrat side or from the Antifa side where they think they're going to get off actually fighting a conflict, because none of them have used guns before. Maybe some of them have, but you can see how they just get owned on social media when they try and talk guns by actual gun people. So anyways, I don't know where they're going to get off thinking that their only strength is mob violence. But once the lead starts flying, I don't think the mob can stand up to maybe a Republican scalpel-like insurrection on the actual gun side. And Tim Pool was talking about this today on YouTube. So I'm jumping around in a lot of places, but I think that's maybe the glory of what I offer, my skill to pull all these seemingly disparate topics and pull them into one narrative. Maybe that's kind of what being a lawyer is pulling all these facts from different places and putting them together. So Tim Pool was talking about that and how there's two different kinds of insurrection activity in light of the Michigan governor, the plot against the Michigan governor being soiled or spoiled or intervened in, thwarted. And he was talking about how right-wing militia violence is more organized and scalpel, maybe not more organized, but it's more pointed, ultra-violent and ultra-violent, pointed, and like a surgical scalpel strike, whereas left-wing violence is like a blunt instrument just bludgeoning with the masses over a long period of time. And I think that's pretty apt from what we've seen in the past. However, I tend to think that right-wing violence is more, it's maybe both sides are kind of instigated by puppeteers, but definitely documented that right-wing violence, as you would call it, is more a creation of the FBI than anything else. Whereas left-wing violence, I don't know. You could talk about George Soros. I think the funding, people have linked the funding, and but I'll defer to that. I'm just speculating here. So it continues. After all, political invective has reached a fever pitch since Hillary Clinton declared that a sizable portion of the United States population constituted, quote, a basket of deplorables, famously. Perhaps not since the 1870s and 1880s, when Catholics, Southerners, and Irish, all core constituents of the Democratic Party, were denounced by Republicans as spies, traitors, and drunks. This happened soon after the Constitution was ratified, and leading up to the ratification, where with the Federalists and the Democratic Republicans, I've talked about that a lot, but a lot of them thought that Jefferson and Madison and all of the Democratic Republicans were actually French agents French agent provocateurs that were under the employ of the French government. So it's funny that something so strange as the Russiagate hoax, what is actually so close to what the heart of our nation is. But so as half the country was so despised, the other half in the 1800s, as early as 2017, when asked of the chances of another civil war in the United States, about one-third of foreign policy scholars polled said it was likely. Perhaps then it is not shocking that we are now seeing articles, even in mainstream publications, suggesting that maybe, just maybe, the United States can't continue in its present form. Moreover, the view is now increasingly being promoted by writers and ideologues outside the usual conservative and libertarian groups that have long advocated in favor of decentralization and local control. On September 18, for example, Steve Chapman in the Chicago Tribune asked, "Can the United States survive this election?" For the past century, the answer given by most any mainstream journalist would have been a decisive yes. The usual narrative has long been this: of course America will endure for centuries to come. We Americans are masters of compromise. We'll all soon realize we are all in this together and come together in unity. Okay, Well, what takes that? What makes that happen? A polarizing event, a false flag. That's what makes that happen historically. Although it's funny that coronavirus being in that strain has created a huge division and worse than that. Interesting. But now Chapman writes, the concept of splitting off is as American as the 4th of July. Okay, I've been saying that for years. The high point of separation sentiment came after Abraham Lincoln's election in 1860, resulting in the Civil War. But New England states contemplated leaving over the War of 1812. The bonds that hold Americans together have frayed, and what happens on November 3rd may do additional damage. No nation lasts forever, and ours won't be the first. This election won't be the end of the United States, but it could be the beginning of the end. Neo-Confederate, you neo-Confederate racist. Chapman, Steve Chapman, you racist. Moreover, Chapman notes that while many no doubt will continue to see the United States as strong and likely to endure indefinitely, such assumptions may be unwise given the reality of experience elsewhere. He writes, in 1970, the Russian dissident Andrei M. Ulrich wrote a book entitled, Will the Soviet Union Survive Until 1984? At the time, the idea of a giant superpower disintegrating sounded like a fantasy, but it eventually came true. Countries like Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia also had broken apart. Britain is leaving the EU, and Scotland could push to leave Britain. It would be folly to think the United States is immune to these forces. Chapman is not alone. Last month in the Philadelphia Inquirer, Chuck Bonvig suspected that maybe the end is near. The country has gone through many periods of strife in my time here, he writes. Assassinations, recessions, desegregation, inflation, gas crises, Watergate, hanging chads, I don't know what that is, the AIDS crisis, is that simps going around hanging chads? The AIDS crisis, 9/11, maybe it's the 24-hour news cycle or the immediacy of social media that makes the landscape seem so bleak, but I don't recall us ever being so divided. No one in our country seems happy today. The right is angry, the left is despondent. Maybe that's reversed. Our nation reminds me of those married couples who try to stay together for the kids but end up making everyone around them miserable. Maybe it's time for a breakup. Just think about it, America. I know how breaking up is hard to do. We used to be good together, but what is the point of having the greatest country in the world if none of us is actually like it? So before my wife gets home and we hear her in the recording come home with the son and I have to go help them out, I'm going to end this. However, it's funny. I'm just reading this a little more. Oh, and so Ryan McMakin touches on Jefferson. And Jefferson explained in an 1803 letter to John Breckinridge that if future states of the Louisiana Territory sought to secede, that was fine with him. He writes, it should become the great interest of those nations to separate from this, if their happiness should depend on it so strongly as to induce them to go through that convulsion, why should the Atlantic states dread it? But especially why should we, their present inhabitants, take a side in such question? And in 1804, Jefferson wrote to Joseph Priestley stating, whether we remain in one confederacy or form into Atlantic and Mississippi confederacies, I believe it not very important to the happiness of either part. So I think decentralization is the only thing that could save us, which is, and this is what Ryan McMakin says, is that, you know, if maybe we could stay together for the kids if we had decision-making power divest back to the states. However, do we really want that? So I'll leave you with it there. Thanks for listening to another episode of Liberty Bigly. I've been seeing the download numbers. Make sure that you share, like, share, subscribe, rate, and review Liberty Bigly to open up the amount of ears that are listening, but maybe we want to reserve this for the Liberty Weekly elite. I don't know. I'll bring it up on the next Liberty Weekly podcast and give it a plug, but thanks so much for listening. I hope you guys are having a great week. Happy Friday, and I'll be out, I think, tomorrow or Sunday with another episode of the Liberty Weekly podcast talking about a really great justice in the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Well, at least one who wrote a really good opinion about ending the lockdowns, or at least more particularly resuming jury trials and not postponing them. So thanks again. Peace.